for argument is 17-2528, Brown versus United States. Whenever you are.
Good morning. May it please the court. The first issue that I'd like to dive into is the question of waiver as to Mr. Brown's shoulder condition. The trial court below found that in its findings, it laid out exactly how
Let me ask you just to cut to the chase. What are you seeking? What is going to happen here if you prevail? Would be sent back to the Court of Federal Claims because they found it was a waiver. But even looking at the issue on the merits of the issue, what were you asking for in terms of this?
So it can go in two directions because the ABCMR has broad discretion to grant a wide amount of relief, but also the way the original application was put forward, it's framed as a request for review, a medical review board, which is not quite correct terminology. That's a state proceeding for National Guard soldiers that's out of use, but a return to an evaluation of whether or not he actually meets or met at the time of his separation in 2000 retention standards. If he gets those retention standards...
So you would assume if you were to prevail at the Court of Federal Claims, the relief you would get would... that this is shipped over to the MEB for analysis?
Almost necessarily, Your Honor, because in order to get to the retirement finding that we ultimately want in that compensation, there needs to be a finding of the percentages under the VA schedule that the plaintiff would be entitled to. And without a lot more fact-finding and development of that, I don't see how it's possible otherwise.
Let me ask you just, because I've been focusing more on the epilepsy, the seizure piece of this than the shoulder piece. Are there prerequisites to get to the MEB that you have satisfied? I mean, is that what the rub is? I mean, even if the Court of Federal Claims sent it back to the board, would it be automatic it goes to the MEB, or is there some predicate to it being sent there?
Well, that's where my colleague and I apparently disagree, but the citations from Army Regulation 40-501, Chapter 3-30I, lay out those prerequisites. Now, the first sort of overarching rule for epilepsy is that seizure disorders and epilepsy...
No, I understand. I don't want to leave the shoulder. The shoulder thing is the same thing, or it's...
Oh, there's a different standard, Your Honor.
Okay. I wanted to stay with the shoulder thing for a moment.
Yes, Your Honor. The standard for failure for shoulder. So there's basically, again, there's another section of 40-501, Chapter 3, that deals with limitations of range of motion. And there's several possible ways you can satisfy failing retention standards. One is whether it's considered just by the limitation of the range of motion by itself.
Okay, and remind me what the board said about this claim, because it didn't. It dealt with it, sort of.
Right? Well, it referenced the evidence that Mr. Brown submitted, but in its discussion session, it really didn't. It just made a conclusory, there was no showing that he meets or fails retention standards. And that's really part of the problem, is that they did not address that. So any sort of guessing about that is very difficult to do because there's no real explanation of why they found what they found.
On the epilepsy aspect, I must admit, I'm very confused about what's happening. You make the argument about whether this is about, it would just be, what's the term you use, that there's, it's summarily fashioned or whatever, what they use, redundant, or, and then you argue that the regulations were different. Well, let's leave those arguments to aside. Are you saying, what are you saying about why there should have been, you're claiming there should have been an MEB review beyond the neurologist's conclusions. And what is the basis for your arguing that?
Right. It's that section quoted 3-30I, which has sort of a number of criteria that when you meet, you get that MEB.
Right.
So the first thing is, seizure disorders in epilepsy are causes for referral to the MEB. And then it says, okay, but epilepsy is normally referred to the MEB, except if a neurologist reviews it, decides that, no, we're going to do a trial of medication and a one-year look at this soldier. And then after that, during that time period, if he has another soldier, another seizure, during that period of review, it automatically goes to the PEB.
And so are you claiming that that's, you fall into that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Because he had another seizure.
Because he had 1996, but, Your Honor, was when he had that first seizure.
Yeah.
And then when they're looking at it and saying, no, you're good to go, in December, 4 or 5 months after he left the Army, they're saying, you're good to go, it's controlled on medication. That's 4 years too late. He had 3 or 4 other seizures in the meantime, dislocated his shoulder, broke his face, falling running.
Yeah, but I thought there was a finding, and I didn't think you, I didn't see where you were disputing it, that when he had another seizure, he was supposed to, he had not been taking the amount of the dosage of this drug, whatever it is, that he was prescribed, and therefore, okay, let's fix this up. And I think after he got on the 300 milligram dosage, there was no evidence on the record that he had another seizure after that. So if he's on, been treated, if once he takes the prescribed dosage, he does not have another seizure, why should he be able to get to the MEB?
What's important is to look at the timelines, Your Honor, because under the view where the 2000 review by the neurologist says, yes, it's controlled on medication, well, that's 4 years too late. He had 1996, he was on the medication, now
that's
your point.
Is it true, though? I'm sorry. I just want to. Mm-hmm. One of the questions was, you don't dispute that he was taking the wrong amount of medication, or I what is the? I'm a little confused about the factual facts on that.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't dispute that there's not a lot of evidence about that, and nothing to dispute in the administrative record itself, except for by making inferences. Some of those inferences. You can find in the record is that there's in that finding by, I believe it was Dr. Moss, who said wrong medication, you've got to, you know, up it to 300, and there's a statement that he was confused or wasn't told to go from 100 milligrams to 300 milligrams. First off, there's no records review. It says right in that same, I think it's at 243, I want to say, but it says no records reviewed. And it's just a reporting of what he said.
Can I ask you, is it your position then that it was not correct that he was taking the incorrect dosage, that the 100 milligrams was what he had been prescribed, and therefore, at that point when he had the second seizure, he should have been sent up? Is that your, to the MEB? Is that your position?
I don't want to sidestep the direct question, but my position is that the physician had the responsibility to set up the medication program for 4 years. He's going to the pharmacy, he's an Army soldier, the Army is issuing him the medication. If they don't know the difference between 100 and 300 milligrams, what are they filling? Why isn't the follow-up happening? And it's the physician's, neurologist's obligation to be treating this soldier and coming up with a plan and resolving it, looking at it with a one-year review. That didn't happen. So from 1996,
your allegation that he was being prescribed pills that were only 100, is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that on the record, it's not clear. My client has expressed some confusion as to the facts of this.
Where did you make that argument in the red brief? Because I saw it kind of touched upon maybe in gray, but I didn't see it in red, in blue. I'm sorry, in your blue brief.
No, Your Honor, it's just a response to your question. The brief.
So what is the allegation that's before our court as to why we should dislodge the conclusion here that they followed the red, he wasn't taking the right treatment, but they're not responsible for that glitch. And once he got on the right treatment, he's fine and no more seizures, so that's okay under the red. If you haven't made that argument, what argument are you making?
Because the use of the wrong regulation, and
So you agree you're not making that, you haven't made that argument.
Right, Your Honor, yes.
Okay.
Can I ask a logistical question? If I were to agree with you that he did not waive his shoulder claim, doesn't everything go back? I mean, I don't decide the epilepsy and the right reg, wrong reg, and what impact that may have had on anything. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. The tenuous code 1216 alpha sub B says requires the...
Everything to be considered together.
All conditions, whether individually or collectively unfitting. And so if one condition goes back, it has to be an entire MEB looking at both individually and collectively how the conditions impact his ability.
Is that 10 U.S.C. 1216A subsection C or B? I think it's
B, Your Honor.
B? Okay.
And I'm into rebuttal time, so thank you, Court.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. To address the seizure issue first, the discussion a moment ago touched upon, the six-month provision in the regulation, which is paragraph 4 of the regulation, I believe Judge Stoll, you correctly pointed out in the record that once he was put on the correct dosage of medication, he was seizure-free.
Well, can I ask about that? Can you turn to page 10 of your brief?
Yes, Your Honor.
To the extent that's a key issue here, and it's not clear to me whether it is or isn't or has been appropriately preserved, but if he had been prescribed the 100 milligrams, and that's what he'd been prescribed, and there was no dispute about that, he had another seizure, the neurologist wouldn't get a do-over, right? He would kind of automatically be allowed to move up to the MEB. Is that correct?
I think if that was after 6 months, right?
Yes. After 6 months. Okay. So a lot of it hinges on whether or not he had been prescribed the right dosage or whether it was based on his own confusion. So when I look to your brief to like, okay, what are you saying about this? And it seems what you're saying is at the top of page 10, the neurologist also noted that Mr. Brown apparently misunderstood the proper dosage for the medication. And then you keep on going with a quote and an insight to a page in the appendix. I don't see where your citation to the appendix tells us that has a notation from the neurologist about him apparently misunderstanding the proper dosage, which seems to me to arguably be a fairly key point. I mean, the insight is then back to 377 of the appendix.
Yes, Your Honor.
And 377, I may be missing something, but the only thing it says about the dosage is, however, the patient has been taking only 100 milligrams, claiming that he has never been told to increase it to 300 milligrams. That's the only reference I see here. So what we have is the patient saying he's never been told to increase it, and nobody else saying anything else. So I don't know where you're getting your neurologist noting that he misunderstood.
The other, it's in our brief, but not directly in this section of the brief. Appendix page 515, which is when he was initially put on the medication in August of 1996.
Okay.
It's handwritten, and it is hard to read this writing.
But doesn't it say Dilantin 300 milligrams for 3 days, then 500 something? I mean, where does that say take 300 milligrams every day? It just says for 3 days, and then there's some other notation about doing something different for 5 days.
Yes, Your Honor, it does say that.
And where do you cite this in your brief?
I believe it's in the factual background when we just addressed when he was first prescribed the medication. I can find the page if you give me a moment. The provision of the regulation, paragraph 4, that talks about the six-month period, to sort of focus on that in this context, is that provision talks about the initiation of treatment. And the record documents that we have available to us, which is all the board had available to it, show that in August of 96, when he was first given medication, he started off with, as Your Honor pointed out, a 300 milligrams, potentially moving up to 500. We don't know exactly what happened over the years between 1996 and when he had a seizure in February of 2000. We only know that, as Judge Proust pointed out, that he wasn't taking 300 milligrams and the...
as Judge Stoll pointed out, this says 300 milligrams times 3 days, then 500 milligrams, and I don't know what else it says, and then the level for five days. So I don't know. Is that the support for your statement on page 10 that says the neurologist also noted that Mr. Brown apparently misunderstood the proper dosage? I mean, did the neurologist make a statement that said, is there a statement in the record that he misunderstood? Because as I said, the site you have only says his saying he'd only had 100.
Your Honor, page 377 of the appendix, which you referred us to, I mean, I didn't mean to mischaracterize the evidence, but it seemed like a fair characterization to say misunderstood. The sentence that I was referring to at page 377 says that, however, the patient has been taking only 100 milligrams, claiming that he had never been told to increase to 300 milligrams. And given the other evidence...
Is it from what?
There isn't evidence in between. And so there's a lot of... I'm taking the evidence that we have, as the corrections board did. The corrections board, and to really focus on, I think the regulation gives us the answer in this type of situation. The regulation, and perhaps the best place to look at that is at appendix page 68.
But going back to whether this statement on page 10 of your red brief is a fair characterization, it talks about increasing it. He didn't know he was supposed to increase it. How can you rely on his initial treatment, that language that's not even clear and says 300 milligrams for, 3 days followed by something else? How can you take it that the neurologist noted that Mr. Brown misunderstood?
I think the corrections board also interpreted it that way, that he should have been taking more medication than he was taking, and that he was mistaken in that regard. That's all we mean by that. We don't mean to impute any sort of intent. It was a mistake. And the reason this matters is it's about whether or not, when was the treatment initiated. That's the initiation of treatment is the language in the regulation.
Is he right, the opposing counsel correct, that 10 U.S.C. 1216A-B requires us to send the whole thing back and not really address the merits of the epilepsy claims and the regulatory issues with the possibly wrong regulation, whether that matters, if we conclude that he did not, in fact, waive the shoulder issue and thus it should have been addressed?
If you decide the correction board should look at the entire case again, it will do so.
No, that's not my question. My question is, if it's true, if he is correct that the shoulder issue was not waived, doesn't that require us to send the whole thing back to be looked at together?
You're correct. The statute requires the corrections board to look at. And on the waiver, before I move to the waiver issue, just one last reference to the regulation regarding the seizure. If paragraph 4 we focused on, which is the six-month issue, Other provisions in that regulation provide some context. It talks about, in paragraph 5, if a seizure should recur during a later attempt to withdraw medication, then decision to refer to a PEB is at the discretion of the physician or of the MEB. Also, there's in paragraph 6 of that regulation some language about if a soldier remains seizure-free for 36 months.
Can I ask you about another document? It's in the appendix at page 324.
Mm-hmm.
This one's dated 1999, so it's like over 3 years after that original 1996 document we're relying on for purportedly showing prescription of 300 milligrams. This document, this page at 324, dated August 1999, seems to, at the bottom, you see it's, says something like Dilantin 300 milligrams now, 300 milligrams tonight, 300 milligrams tomorrow, something like that. It looks like maybe it's a new prescription. I don't know. But that this document seems to be a little bit before the neurologist report that is dated 2000. So have you considered this and what this is saying here and whether this is changing his prescription?
It seems to be another indication that he should have been taking 300 milligrams and wasn't for whatever reason, whether it was a misunderstanding or a failure to
communicate. Or is this a new prescription? I mean, how do you know that this means that he should have known or should have been given, or that he was given, let me straighten that out, that he was given 300 milligrams per day as early as 1996 for the initial treatment?
It's not clear that it's a new prescription or not. I can't, as Your Honor is unable to conclude, as I am also unable to conclude. Ultimately, we know that once he was taking the 300 milligrams, once he was actually taking it, because even if Your Honor, if that was, let's assume it was a new prescription then, it appears that he didn't take the prescription as prescribed several months later when he had his seizure in February of 2000. It was discovered that he had been taking 100, which was, I think the document you just showed me was in late 1999, so it was several months before. So that's our position on this specific issue, is that for the seizure, that once he was treated, once he was following the treatment, once the treatment was initiated, which is the language in the regulation, he was seizure-free, and that document's in the record demonstrate that. That's the position of the government on the seizure issue, is that once the treatment had been initiated.
But if, in fact, he had been prescribed 100, and then he had another seizure, under my reading of the regulation, he gets to go move up to the MEB. The doctor, if it's 4 months later, the doctor, the neurologist doesn't, I mean, the whole point of this is that the neurologist doesn't get to continually experiment on the correct dosage. You get kind of one try, and if that doesn't work, you move you up to the MEB, right?
There is a period of where there's a trial and error period that is right. Contemplated in the regulations, and after that period's over,
okay.
He should be referred. This is an important point. Also, the corrections board, the Barnett case, which is cited in our brief, states that the corrections board essentially, if a service member doesn't have an MEB or a PEB, that the corrections board can give that service member the review that a PEB would have provided, and it could take the place of the PEB. So here, when Mr. Brown went to the corrections board, the corrections board considered all of the evidence that was presented to it, all of the medical records that were provided, decided that he was fit for duty at the time that he had been separated, which was several years, 13 years before, because this corrections board process didn't start for about 13 years after service ended. So we know that he was given this review by the corrections board, which is essentially what he would have gotten from a PEB initially. Barnick tells us that. We also know that this court reviews these decisions de novo. And so we think the trial court is correct, and we think even if you have a different basis upon which you would want to rule from the trial court based upon the record, of course, under the law you can do that as long as the record supports such a basis, because this is de novo review. And there is no evidence in the record here, as the trial court correctly observed, to show that he's unfit for duty. And ultimately, the fitness question is what is at issue, is whether, because if he's fit for duty, he does not, he is not entitled to disability compensation. So the Corrections Board made that determination. And as to the shoulder, our position is that the Corrections Board addressed that issue to the extent it was raised by Mr. Brown. He didn't raise it as a separate basis for unfitness. It was raised in the context of this case, but he focused on his petitions to the Corrections Board, and he filed three petitions to the Corrections Board. All of them focused on the seizure condition, and to the extent the shoulder condition was referenced, it was a secondary point. The ultimate decision of the Corrections Board on reconsideration, it addressed the shoulder condition and discussed it at some length and decided that within the profiles, the limitations of his duty that were given to him because of his various conditions, that he was fit for duty. And that's a decision that the Army is afforded deference for that decision, as the cases say.
I'm sorry, just to clarify, what is the standard you think that we use to determine whether or not there was waiver? Do you think that's a question of fact or law? What is the appropriate standard of review that you believe we ought to apply?
For waiver, the trial court decision on that, it would be an abuse of discretion standard, I believe, Your Honor. But here, the waiver issue, I think, is not as important because ultimately the Corrections Board addressed all the claims that were presented to it and it discussed the shoulder. It didn't assess it at length like it did the seizure, but
this is what kind of annoys me, and I want to see if you think it's fair to be annoyed.
Yes, Your Honor.
You're basing the waiver argument, as I understand it, it has to be based on the fact he never raised it at the board. So you're trying to have it both ways. He waived it because if he had raised it appropriately at the board, then there would be no waiver.
Yes, Your Honor.
So you're arguing, well, in the alternative, one, it was waived, but even if it wasn't waived, they dealt with it. I mean, it's kind of, I don't know that it seems right for you to get to have these alternative arguments presented.
I understand your frustration. I think this case from the beginning, there were a lot of different claims, and over time, many of them have fallen off. There was a hernia claim at the trial court that was deemed waived that wasn't raised here. There were another claim at the trial court that he withdrew and
right,
was
I
briefed.
Understand that. And but so, you understand my, I mean, is the government's position that he raised it at the board and the board dealt with it and they want us to affirm on
I don't mean to waffle
about it?
I don't mean to waffle, but I guess to the extent he raised the shoulder in his filings with the board addressed his shoulder to some degree. Whether it's squarely addressed, that whether or not the shoulder could get, could provide by itself.
We can't possibly affirm that if it was a merits determination because the trial court said it was waived, so she didn't deal with it at all. So at a minimum, under that theory, we'd still have to send it back to the Court of Claims, right?
Or
she found waiver. Right?
If you think that he didn't waive this claim, I suppose that is true.
On yes. Page 132 of the appendix, it refers to seizures requiring surgeries. Do you know what those surgeries are? Does it have to do with the shoulder at all?
That's my understanding, yes.
It's a shoulder surgery.
Yes. I believe his first shoulder dislocation occurred from a seizure.
And that's in the application for correction of military record. I think it's maybe the one of them, one of the applications.
Thank you. If I may, I just want to address the Appendix 324. The question as to whether or not that document is a new prescription or not. I point out to the court that that's the emergency care and treatment record from when he fell and hit his face on the surgery. For seizure, and at the bottom it says instructions to patient dated that date. So to me, that suggests strongly that that's a new direction as to what medication to take. And it's also from Dr. Kolbliar's, the neurologist at the bottom, who's directing that from the emergency department after he fell. So just wanted
to... Is that the same neurologist that's on the other document or no?
No, Your Honor, different. I believe that the second one clearing him was Lieutenant Colonel Moss, I believe. The my colleague raises the point of the trial court's finding that Mr. Brown never showed that he was unfit. And there's a really important distinction here between unfitness and fails retention standards. Failing retention standards is what gets you to the MEB. The MEB, once it convenes, looks at your conditions and basically documents them to be forwarded to the PEB. Now the PEB it's a sub-agency, the agency that does the unfitness determination. So Mr. Brown wasn't asking for an unfit finding, he was asking for a medical review or an MEB. So the idea that he didn't show that he was unfit just really doesn't gel or fit into the to the applications. And just then briefly on the shoulders not being raised as being unfit, he talked about he couldn't do push-ups, he couldn't do any overhead work. This is a soldier who's a E6 squad leader in the Army with communications gear, which involves putting up antennas, lifting, it's physical work. So that by itself does actually indicate both failing retention standards, but also is an indication of unfitness, because if you can't lift things up as a communication sergeant, you're going to be unfit. And just to address exactly the unfit, that's from Army Regulation 635-40, which is the question of reasonableness of the ability to perform the duties expected of a soldier of that grade, rank, rating, or office, which basically means your rank and what job you have in the military. So you can have these MEB conditions that are just a laundry list and applies to every soldier. But when you get over to the PEB, it really depends on your job, because if you're an admin soldier and you're in the office doing admin work all day, well, that's a different degree of physical requirements than an infantry soldier in the field running with a ruck and a rifle and doing all kinds of physical activity. If the court has any more questions?
Thank you. Thank both sides, and the case is submitted. The final case for argument is